Everybody, welcome to another edition of the 19th Hole Golf Show. Ryan Ballinger, it's good to have you here with us. Get a hold of me on Twitter at Ryan Ballinger. Get a hold of Golf News Net on your favorite social media service at the handle Golf News Net. We're starting to post on Facebook again, so if you'd like to come join us over there, we'd love to have you. Facebook.com/Golf News Net. We're posting new videos to our Amazon Fire TV and Roku TV channels, and we are presented by our friends at 2Under. They are the purveyors of asset management. And they make the best darn underwear in the world. They make underwear that makes it more enjoyable to play golf with their famous Joey pouch that keeps your assets apart from your body so they're not sweaty, so there's no chafing, they stay dry, and you have a comfortable walk. Hopefully you're walking on the golf course. They also make fantastic underwear for when you're in the gym and for when you're in the boardroom and even for when you sleep. And I love their underwear. Wear it routinely. It's extremely comfortable. Lots of different designs. Collegiate patterns for those of you who want to wear your undergarments featuring the logos of your university or the one you root for, the one you attended, or both, I guess. And they also make some great loungewear, bags, socks, all kinds of other apparel as well. So head over to the number 2undr.com. Use the promo code GNN20. You will save 20% on any order you make. Not just your first order, every order with the promo code GNN20 at 2under.com. Kind of two parts to this show this week. First, some reaction to Tiger Woods winning the Tour Championship, his 80th PGA Tour win. And then the second half of the show, a little bit of a Ryder Cup preview prediction segment, since we know the first four matches for Friday morning, the four balls that were announced in the way too long opening ceremony this morning in Paris. But let's focus first on Tiger and winning the Tour Championship. Did you ever imagine this day was going to come? I mean, in November, December, when Tiger said, "Hey, I'm coming back. I'm going to play the Hero World Challenge." And you're like, he picked that golf course because he can put himself in the field, and it's as flat as can be. He doesn't have to walk up and down hills. It's got five par fives, so I mean, there's nothing to concern yourself with. It's easy scoring. He'll have a great time. And it won't matter if he finishes dead last. And he beat half the field. And you're like, well, you know, there's something there. Maybe it's getting better. And then he made the cut at Torrey. He grinded to get to the weekend. And then he played not so great at Riviera. But then he decided to add Tampa. And he T12'd at Honda. And he nearly won the Valspar, finishing T2 to Paul Casey, who had to play the best round of his PGA Tour career at age 41 to beat Tiger Woods. Then he goes to Arnie's place, nearly wins at Bay Hill, puts up a great fight on Sunday before falling short, pulling driver, literally was a mistake on 16, the par 5 that kind of knocked him out, even though no one was beating Rory McIlroy that day. He goes to the Masters, okay. Nearly gives us a great tease of winning at Memorial, got to the lead on the weekend. You're like, oh man, this could really be happening, and then, nope, didn't happen. Played like crap at Quail Hollow in the interlude. Played pretty well at the Players' Championship in May. So that was his May. Was just atrocious at the U.S. Open. There were a lot of stars that were probably on the wrong side of the draw that week and just never contended. And then he came to my hometown, to the D.C. area event, the National, for the final time, and got out a new putter. He used a mallet, wing mallet putter, kind of hybrid putter, from TaylorMade. And the Ardmore 2, the black copper version, which is a beautiful putter, by the way. And I figured then and there, he's done and dusted. There's no way this guy continues to search for answers and never finds them and does something great this year. And sure enough, he holds the lead for an hour alone on Sunday at the Open Championship. Now, yeah, he had to be gifted what three guys in front of him needed to give him, which was four shots very early in the round, and he couldn't finish it off. He tried to play a conservative style, which was kind of befitting of the conditions early on in the day. He made a mistake, made a double bogey, what, 11, and that cost him the whole thing. He never recovered from that moment. And when the wind started to aid him as he came back to the clubhouse, he just was not able to capitalize. Meanwhile, Francesco Molinari played mistake-free, perfect golf, basically, and capped off the best year of his career. Then we get into August and the final August PGA Championship, at least in recent to come memory, and he shoots 130 on the weekend. He's never done that That's his best 36-hole total for two rounds, any two rounds, in a major championship. And he's won 14 of them, so that's kind of remarkable. He shot 199, I believe, 196, excuse me, for the final 54 holes. He spotted the field two strokes on the second hole of the tournament by plunking a easy second shot into the water. That's basically the difference between him getting into a playoff with Brooks Koepka and him being happy, ecstatic to finish solo second. Improving in that moment and in the moment where he held the lead at the Open, that he can get back there, that he can compete, and that he can be relevant. And you figure, okay, well, everything's going to look great for the majors next year. Why not try to cap off this year with a victory? Kind of battled putting a little bit throughout the year, getting into the playoffs. He battled driving throughout the year, tried a couple of different shafts, a couple of different clubs, trying to figure it all out, put in some new irons from TaylorMade, which apparently dialed in right away because those Phase 1 puppies were and have been just fantastic for him. He's number one on the PGA Tour in strokes gained on the approach. And he gets into the playoffs and decides, I'm going to change two things. I'm going to change my putter, try to Juno putter from TaylorMade, which is kind of their version of an answer style. It's not exactly, but an answer style, trying to mimic his Scotty Cameron Newport 2 GSS. Decides that doesn't work, goes back to the Scotty. Okay, back in business for the BMW Championship with the Scotty. Putts pretty well, finished with T6. Also before the playoffs, makes a critical change in his shaft. Goes back to an old Mitsubishi shaft he used about 5 years ago when he was winning five times a year on the PGA Tour. And he's starting to find fairways again. Not that they're perfect. I mean, he still hits poor drives, but he's always done that. But it felt like he was more comfortable hitting the cut. He could kind of work the ball both ways. And all of that culminated throughout the playoffs with what he ultimately did at Eastlake, which was as close to a vintage performance I think there could be from Tiger Woods. He got out there on Thursday. He just murked Tommy Fleetwood, who was not prepared to play with a guy who was going to play that well and have a crowd that much on Tiger's side as opposed to his. He then plays with Ricky on Friday. Destroys him. It's not even close. You get to Saturday. You've got Justin Rose in a big time pairing. Tiger goes out in 30 with a bogey. That's remarkable. He had Justin Rose on his heels all day. Beat him by what? Two or three in the end. And they get to Sunday and it's with Rory. And you figure, okay, Rory's got to be able to stand up. He said after the British Open that he wanted to be the kind of guy that would ruin Tiger Woods' comeback party, kind of damper it a little bit, give him a reality adjustment. This is 2018, that guy's 42, and I'm better than him. And guess what Rory McIlroy did? Choked. He was out of it six holes into the round. He was a bystander one-third of the way in to the final round at Eastlake. The only guy that Tiger Woods really had to care about on Sunday was Billy Horschel. And no offense to Billy Horschel, who's a mighty fine player and had a great playoffs and has won, what, four times on the PGA Tour. But he is not Tiger Woods. He isn't even Rory. He's not Justin Rose. He's not Dustin Johnson, the other guys that were competing for the FedEx Cup. He's not Tony Finau, even, in that sense, at least this year, currently. It was no contest. Tiger was only stymied a little bit by his own realization that he was going to win and that all he had to do from basically 12 on was don't put the ball in the water and get to the clubhouse without making a boatload of bogeys. And he made two bogeys, that is, and that was okay. He made consecutive bogeys in 15 and 16. 17 hit an approach shot that probably was better than it turned out. Probably should have deserved a better chance at making birdie. Makes a par. Gets to 18, hits a 348-yard drive on 18. To me, that was the moment of the week. When you imagine a year ago, Woods was saying he was just happy to be okay, getting the thumbs up from his doctors to be able to swing, to chip, to putt, to start to move through the bag just a little bit. And a year later from spinal fusion surgery, from that date in September, so 17 months removed from that, he was hitting a driver 348 yards in the final group in the final round of the Tour Championship with a chance to get to 13th in the world with a victory. That's a huge change in a year. This time a year ago, Tiger was 1,142nd in the official world golf ranking. As he put that final putt in at East Lake, he became 13th in the world. That's bonkers. That's unheard of. And believe it or not, the official world golf ranking formula handicaps Tiger Woods this year and next year, too, because he's only played 22 events in this current two-year cycle. So the official world golf ranking rates over a rolling 104-week period. Points lose value over time after 13 weeks and equal 91-week installments, and ultimately those start to lose value. But the assumption of the ranking also is that you're going to play at least 40 tournaments, 40 qualifying tournaments in that time frame, meaning you would play 20 events a year. It's reasonable, but Tiger wouldn't have played 20 tournaments in 2017. So he still gets what's called the minimum divisor in his ranking to kind of handicap him because he didn't play that many events. And so that's designed to prevent someone from, like, John Rahm, when he came out and was third in his first tournament or whatever, from having world ranking points from finishing third with one tournament as an advisor, and all of a sudden he's the new number one in the world. That's why that's there. So that's why Tiger Woods is handicapped. But if you took away that minimum divisor in the official world golf ranking, Tiger Woods would have become number one in the world with his win at the Tour Championship. Number one in the world. Can you believe that? That's How is that possible? How could a guy who was dreading getting out of bed in the morning before he had a spinal fusion, and probably still had to deal with that to some extent as he recuperated from it, how can that guy be the guy who swings 120 miles per hour, plays a nice, beautiful, controlled fade, is number one on the PGA Tour in strokes gained on the approach, figures out putting, figures out his short game. By the way, that guy had chip yips a couple of years ago. He was shanking chips. He was chipping with mid-irons, so he wouldn't worry about shanking them. And that guy is now 13th in the world. I did not cry. I am an emotional guy, as you probably know over the years of doing this show. I didn't cry, though. I thought I might. I thought I might tear up a little bit. It got close maybe once or twice to starting to tear up. But I was just happy. I was happy for that guy. Tiger's gone through a lot, and a lot of that is self-imposed. I mean, he ruined his marriage because of his poor decision-making and his selfishness and how he treated other people. He got arrested for DUI because he was addicted to those painkillers or whatever he was in, that cocktail of stuff that could have killed him, by the way, that was in his system. He couldn't manage the pain from his recuperation. And he got that sorted out. He found someone he loves and his girlfriend, Erica Herman. I think they've been together more than a year, so I assume they love each other. And he got a chance to play golf again at a professional level. And he did it with, has done it so far at least, with a level of gratitude, humbleness, that guy did not exist when Tiger was winning in 2013. And to see him now as not only the elder statesman that people just want to see win one more time, but the elder statesman that did win one more time, that put a big smile on my face. And you can dislike the guy forever. I understand. If you are personally offended by what he did or how he treated golf in the past, how he probably took advantage of the fact that he was the best player in the world, and frankly, he still is the best player in the world, and that he moved the needle, and that he was the reason in his eyes, not really true, but he was the reason in his eyes tour purses were going up, and that he was basically the reason Nike was in golf, period. Now he's at a different point in his life. He's a different guy. Guy who's a father of two kids about to go into middle school, and he wanted to show them what his old man could, what their old man could do, even if it looked just a little bit not quite resembling what he used to do and what they could watch on a tape library a mile long of his accomplishments. That makes me happy. I do this every day in part because I love this challenge and I love the sport, but part of me also wants to show my kids that I can do this. I want to show my wife that I can do this. And I want to show myself that I can do this. And in that, I can empathize and appreciate what Tiger's gone through and accomplished in this comeback. It basically a year-long comeback. He won the Tour Championship, which had 23 of the top 30 players in the world in it. He didn't beat a bunch of scrubs. He didn't win the Buick Open in 09 when there was like one top 1,000 player in the field, and he just destroyed everybody else just to wave goodbye in gratitude to the Detroit market. He didn't do that. He took on some of the best players in the world the week before the biggest golf competition in the world, the Ryder Cup, and made it look easy. He is now the Masters betting favorite. That is frightening. Because I know he can win it. I know he can win the Masters. And the PGA Championship is after that at Bethpage in May. Guess what? He's won there. So he could win there too. Anyhow, the whole thing is just... it's next year has the potential to be incredible. It really does. And it could be totally disappointing in every way. And I want to kind of put a coda on this that, yeah, Tiger came back and won. And that's what we wanted. We wanted to see it one more time. Yeah, you wanted to see it one more time in a major? Well, you got it twice. So if you want to evaluate in the meta sense, the larger sense, whether this comeback has been successful, you're damn right it's been. It has been extremely successful and probably better than you thought it was going to be. Way better than I thought it was going to be. So if that's the case, then whatever happens from here is exactly like Tiger Woods said in 2015. Gravy from here. Another major, amazing. Another win, awesome. Get to Sam Snead, beat him, cool. Get closer to Jack Nicklaus, it'll be phenomenal. If you get to Jack Nicklaus or pass him, oh my God. Now we're talking Ben Hogan comeback territory. By the way, I want to touch on that for a brief second. The idea that this comeback compared to Ben Hogan's comeback and the greatest comebacks in sports history. I mean, they're all a little different, of course, right? I mean, you've got George Foreman, who came out of retirement, won the heavyweight boxing title of the world against a horrible opponent, by the way, at 45, right? You've got Mario Lemieux, that came back from leukemia, become one of the best in hockey again. There are lots of... you've got Andre Agassi, who came back from meth and coke and all kinds of crap. You've got Jennifer Capriati, who came back from drug abuse and won a couple of majors. I mean, there are a lot of stories of people who've come back from horrible things they've done to themselves or injuries or what have you, and have reclaimed some sense of their former glory, if not outright outshined who they were before then. I don't know the Tiger's comebacks better than Ben Hogan's. I mean, the guy nearly died in a car wreck. He kind of had to bathe in Epsom salts and wrap himself up before every round just to be able to get through it. But he found a way to win four major championships right since the accident, four or five, after the car accident, that he was willing to die for his wife so that she might survive. I know that the counter argument is Tiger's been through a lot. He could barely walk at times, the physical trauma, the self-imposed trauma, the stuff with the pills and the issues with substance abuse, the DUI, the public embarrassment, the mental trauma of having to feel like you might not be able to play golf again and having to try to change your game so you could deal with your bad back and getting the chip yips and all that stuff. I get it. But for me, the differences are in the what happened to lead to precipitate the need for a comeback. The results of the comeback are in favor of Ben Hogan. And I'm not saying that Tiger's going to win, got to catch Jack, basically, to have had as good of a comeback as Ben Hogan. I think we can have this conversation for another day, but you can't also automatically say that Tiger's comeback is the best ever. We have a lot of years to watch Ben Hogan come back and basically play as limited of a schedule of golf as he was possibly allowed and still dominated the majors for years. So let's put a pause on that. We'll come back to that later, but whatever he has done and whatever he's going to do from here is pretty incredible from where he was. And I think we can just leave it at that. Let's go ahead and talk about the Ryder Cup, shall we? Ryder Cup starts tomorrow in Paris. If you are listening to this now, you're probably listening to this as the matches get underway, I'm guessing, for a lot of you. It starts at 2 a.m. Eastern on the Golf Channel. It's going to run from basically 2 a.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern time tomorrow. We have four ball matches to start the day on Friday. We found those out after an hour long ceremony leading up to them. Oh, they've got to cut that out. I mean, honestly, could they just hand out a Xerox of the matches and let the rest of us who just care about the golf go away? I mean, I'm sure the French woman who was singing that I muted was very, very nice. Phil Mickelson was dancing. I'm sure she did a great job singing. That's wonderful. I know that these countries and the European Tour and the PGA of America, when they host, they all put in a lot of work and a lot of money to make this thing go right and get people interested and drum up support and sell tickets and put people in hotel rooms. I get all of that, and there are a lot of people to thank for that. But you don't have to do that in such a public setting for an hour where you kind of start to lose the plot and start to lose the attention of people who want to watch the greatest sporting event in golf, if not the greatest sporting event, period, in the world today, and they just want to know the darn matches. But that all said, we've got four matches. They are four balls, which means they are best ball. The alternate shot or foursomes format is in the afternoon. They're going to do that the same way both days. Four ball in the morning, foursomes in the afternoon. Smart of Thomas Bjorn to kick off with four balls, send out your best players then, and then see what they can do, rearrange, and try to make up points if you need to in the afternoon, but force the Americans to send out their best players and their best duos, and then maybe create the necessity to send out your awkward duos in the afternoon in the format where you really need the most cohesion. Anyhow, here are the four matches. So starting off, Brooks Koepka and Tony Finau for the United States against Justin Rose and Jon Rahm. I really like both of those pairings. I especially like Rose and Rahm. I know Stenson is sitting out in the morning. Rahm is a very suitable replacement. He's really similar in a lot of ways. I mean, he's long off the tee. He can actually use his driver, unlike Henrik Stenson. He's a streaky putter. That's Henrik Stenson. He's a pretty solid approach player. That's Henrik Stenson. Justin Rose is a very strong driver of the ball. Long enough by any means. Very straight, very accurate. Much better putter in terms of strokes gained on the PGA Tour compared to Jon Rahm. And probably a slightly better approach player. So they can both play similar styles. Not exactly the same, but they can play styles that are complementary. I like Koepka and Finau a lot. I like the confidence to send out Tony Finau, a rookie, in the first match with a guy like Brooks Koepka. They can play a similar brand of golf. Koepka, who's been through this in 2016 and thrived, I thought, in Hazeltine, can kind of put his arm around Finau, let those guys swagger a little bit, have some fun, play big boy golf, just bomb and gouge. And if you put the ball in play, as Koepka tends to do, that's great. Finau is a little bit more wayward with the driver, so he'll kind of have to figure his way around Le Golf National, given the circumstances of the match and all that stuff. But I like that. I do think Rose and Rahm will win that match, however. The rest of the slate looks darn good for the United States. Match two is Dustin Johnson and Ricky Fowler against what I think is a surprise pairing in Rory McIlroy and rookie Thorbjørn Olesen, the Thunder Bear, from Denmark. I didn't expect that pairing, to be truthful with you. I mean, I know they get along. They're both Nike guys. Beyond that, I mean, they don't see that much of each other. Rory plays predominantly in the United States. Olesen has been camped out squarely on the European Tour for the last few years. He kind of goes through these runs where he plays tremendous, tremendous golf, playing to his world-class talent, and then he kind of slumps back a little bit. Made this team one of the final guy on points, and he's definitely got the game to compete, but he's never been in this competition before, and he's playing with a guy in McIlroy who apparently is working with Pete Cowan this week on the range. Meanwhile, his instructor forever, Michael Bannon's at home, I guess, in Northern Ireland doing something else. Maybe he's been fired, I don't know, but if you're making a swing change the week of the Ryder Cup, we've got problems. Meanwhile, we've got Dustin Johnson, who's played as consistent golf as any human being on the planet this year, shy of Justin Rose, and you've got Ricky Fowler, who is basically worth a half point, almost guaranteed, in his career in the Ryder Cup. He's basically guaranteed a tie. I mean, he's literally a half point every match. That's his average. So that's good. You want that kind of steady guy. You want a guy who's a bit of a Swiss Army knife. Ricky can do a little bit of everything with his game, but most importantly in this format, he can make what you need. He can make pars, he can make birdies, he can make eagles, he can be the lead guy, he can kind of be the steady guy, he can do it all. I like that team a lot. Match three is where you can start if you would like to. If things go sideways, then you can question Jim Furyk because we've broken up Captain America and Jordan Spieth. So Jordan Spieth is going to play with Justin Thomas, who was not on the 2016 Ryder Cup team, by the way. So the good buddies take on the English duo of Paul Casey, who hasn't been in this competition in 12 years and is not playing his best golf at the moment, and Tyrrell Hatton, who's never been in this competition before, is extremely hot-headed, gets emotional very easily, good or bad, and could go sideways very quickly if it doesn't play well. So I think the good buddies will probably do well, but Spieth is obviously the big question mark in that duo. Will he all of a sudden be reinvigorated to his Ryder Cup self after the most disappointing year of his professional career, or will JT just carry the load? And JT could probably do that. Honestly, JT could win this match by himself. But I think that the good buddies get the job done. Then the final match is Patrick Reed teaming up with Tiger Woods, which is the most swaggerific team I can imagine on the American side, taking on the Open champion Francesco Molinari and Tommy Fleetwood in the anchor match. Molinari and Fleetwood are going to put up a good fight. Molinari's an incredible putter, great ball striker, world-class player. I still maintain he will win a major someday. And Molinari is coming off the best season of his entire career. This is the best year of his life in terms of being a professional golfer. And he's so steady. I mean, he just is steady. That's the problem with this team. If Tiger, who's playing the best golf on the planet right now, and Patrick Reed kind of work off of each other in terms of talent and swagger, Molinari is not going to be able to compete. He's just not going to make that many birdies, I don't think, and compare to what you're going to see from Tiger and Reed. But I think Fleetwood could carry the day, too. I still think the Americans win the final three matches. I think they win this session 3-1. But this could be the one that might surprisingly turn 2-2. So that would be the one to look out for. I have a hard time believing the Americans. I know they're better on paper, ranking-wise. But I have a hard time believing that all of a sudden, just because they're better in the algorithmic formula that we pointed out earlier that is tragically flawed in a lot of ways, that they're all of a sudden just going to be the favorite and win this whole thing. They haven't won. The Americans have not won on foreign soil in 25 years. Were it not for the miracle at Medina in 2012, which never should have happened, there would have been 6 straight Ryder Cups won on home soil for the home team. It's really hard to win on the road in this competition. Really, really, really hard. And the Americans have not found a way to do it in a quarter century. That history doesn't necessarily have the weight on it. I mean, maybe some expectations weight on these guys, but they weren't playing 25 years ago, and I get that. But winning on foreign soil with 50,000 people largely cheering against you every day is really hard to do. I don't care if you're the best players in the world or not. It's just kind of hard. It's psychologically difficult to deal with people wishing you ill as you play golf on an already difficult game, on an already difficult course. I still think the Americans can win. I think maybe if they win, it's like 15-13, something like that. Like they eke it out. But I don't think they're going to win a blowout. I don't think that's possible. But I do think the Americans can win. So here's the interesting thing. And I don't necessarily believe the efficacy of this statistic, but basically of the last 19 Ryder Cups, the team that won the first match won, I believe, 15 of them, something like that, 13 or 15 of them. It's a stat that Randall Shambly is trying to shove down people's throats as an indicator of the winner of the Ryder Cup. I don't think that that's true. It just so happens to work out that way. I don't necessarily see a connection between those two things. But the psychology of being down immediately maybe has something to do with it, maybe forces a captain to make some changes. Everyone has a plan until they're punched in the mouth. But I find it hard to believe that winning the first match means typically you would win the whole thing. I can't see that. But we will see, I guess, right? I'm not willing to draw that conclusion yet, but I do think the Americans will win in the end. I don't think it's going to be easy. I think it will be close, and I think we are underestimating how good Europe actually is in this format, in this competition, and on home soil, even though there's not a French person on this team at all. But I still think the Americans can do it. This is my favorite competition. It really is. I mean, I love watching the major championships. I love watching a lot of golf tournaments. I don't love watching pro golf as much as I used to, but I love watching the Ryder Cup. I love watching match play. I love watching world-class golfers take on each other with a psychology that's different than you have every week, where you have guys who, oh, I don't look at the leaderboard. Well, you have to look at the leaderboard at match play. Otherwise, you lose. You have to care about what your opponent is doing. You can't just play your own game, or you lose. you can't do the things that you do to psychologically protect yourself in stroke play or metal play, or you lose, or it's just bad strategy. And then there's the psychology, there's the intrigue, there's the developments that come from being the captain. Who do you play? Who do you sit? Who do you pair? When do you pair them? When do you send them out? There's a lot of drama that comes in the Ryder Cup, and it's just over 3 days. But those 28 matches are the best. They really are. I wish we had the Ryder Cup every year. The President's Cup just needs to be more competitive, and otherwise I would love it the same, or nearly the same. Nothing's ever going to replace the Ryder Cup. But this is the best competition we have in golf. So get up early if you can. If you're on the East Coast, 2 a.m., maybe sleep. Go to sleep at 9, 10 o'clock tonight. If you've got kids like me, wake up at 2 a.m., watch a little first match, go back to bed, get up maybe 5 when the first match is done, get some idea of where the points are on the board, and then strap in for an afternoon of great golf. Well, early morning, I guess. Afternoon there of great golf. Before you go to work, if you can watch golf from 5 to like 8 before you leave and then kind of stroll in at 8:30, 9 a.m., you've done it. You've done a great thing. Unfortunately, if you're on the West Coast, I fear you may be screwed watching the end. But at 2 a.m. Eastern, we're talking 11 p.m. Pacific for the start time on Golf Channel. And that means you get to watch absolute late night golf, which is pretty cool. So maybe you watch the opening session, go to sleep, get up, go to work. You miss the second half, but it's going to be a great day of golf. Great 3 days of golf. And hopefully it's as good as advertised. Hopefully it's as close as advertised. I know we have lots of folks outside of the United States listening to this, so I'm not going to root against Europe actively on the show, but I do think the Americans are better and are going to win. All right, that's going to do it for us this week on the show. Next week, we'll review the Ryder Cup a little bit. We still have some time before we get into the new PGA Tour season, so we'll touch on a couple of other issues. We've still got lots and lots to come this year in the world of golf as we start up a new PGA Tour season. We round up the end of the European Tour season. We've got all kinds of stuff going on. On the LPGA Tour, we've got a team competition there in a couple weeks. Champions Tour, got some world travels planned. Going to Mexico in the middle of October. Lots and lots to come on the show. So, if you listen to us on iTunes, please give us a 5-star rating. Helps us reach more people. Someone gave us a 1-star rating last week. I think they just were upset about something I wrote because they also, I think, gave 1-star reviews to a bunch of YouTube videos I did. I don't know anything about that. But 5-star reviews are appreciated, and we appreciate you listening to the show and helping us reach more people. If you have feedback on the show, email me, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com, or reach me on Twitter, @RyanBallingy. It's always a thrill to hear from you. It's always fun to have a conversation with you. That's part of the point of doing the show, is to have an ongoing conversation with each other about the sport that we love and probably spend way too much money caring about. But until next time, I'm Ryan Ballingy saying thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next time on the 19th Hole Golf Show.